Today on Maine Calling, gardening tips and solutions for the peak season. Maine gardeners are rejoicing this summer, mainly because the weather is so much better than last year. How does your garden look? Is it bursting with hydrangeas? Are you already harvesting tomatoes? Or is there something wrong, some new disease or insect causing problems? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, it is our midsummer gardening show with horticulture experts on hand to answer your questions. We'll also discuss some eco-conscious trends in gardening, from native trees to smaller lawns, embracing clover, and upgrading to battery-powered tools. And we'll explore how the recent change in the USDA plant hardiness map is affecting what can be grown here. We're donning our sun hat and gloves for some time in the garden. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Summertime gardening can be the best, but also challenging. We'll find out what you can do to help your garden thrive and also to help the environment. And we will answer all of your gardening questions, or at least as many as we can get to. Joining me this hour, Catherine Garland, Kate Garland, horticulture professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension, Caleb Goosen, crop and conservation specialist with Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, MOFCA, and Cheryl Rich, chair of the horticulture department at Southern Maine Community College. We invite you to join the conversation. Ask your questions. What are you grappling with in your garden? What's going well? We'd love to hear some success stories. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us. Looking forward to hearing the questions people have about their gardens on this beautiful July day. Caleb, I'm going to start with you because I'm going to start with one of the biggest stories in New England this year. And that is that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of hydrangeas that are just doing fantastic. It is a bumper year for hydrangeas, perhaps the best ever. Why?
I think it's a good example of something that's always a little hard for folks to remember, which is that a lot of what we're seeing this year is a product of the previous year. And that's particularly true for these perennial shrubs. And not all hydrangeas bloom on pre-existing wood, but a lot of them do. So a lot of those flower buds that are opening and that we're seeing right now were actually made last year. So the conditions last year, while very difficult for some crops, were also very beneficial for some others that thrive when they have plenty of water around. So that's probably a big part of it. Also, there was very very mild wet winter conditions this year. So there was a really low probability of winter injury, which, you know, we maybe see somewhat regularly on some of our plants where things don't necessarily thrive because of those cold stretches.
So this is kind of a reward for making it through last year. Beautiful hydrangeas everywhere. I want to ask each of you, because each of you are in positions where you take questions from gardeners, from growers, and you figure out what's going on for them. And I just want to ask what you're seeing this year, what you're hearing about this year. Kate Garland, I'll start with you. Is there a trend? Are there bugs or diseases that we're seeing more of this year?
That's a great question, Jennifer. Our questions come in ranging all over the place, from invasive species management to diagnosing diseases and insect identification. But I guess one thing, if I were to say there was a trend that I really appreciate seeing, is that there's a lot of folks that are really motivated to manage invasive species. So it's been great to encourage that and cheer folks on and give them the tools and resources on how to manage things in their specific landscape, because a lot of times it's not a one size fits all approach. It really does come down to having a conversation about the unique scenarios that people are dealing with and the particular plants they're dealing with and how to dispose of them too. So I think I like that trend.
That's tricky. I was going to say, when you're talking about managing invasive species, you're not just talking about weeds, often things that were have been in the past intentionally planted. Maybe you've inherited a home that has burning bush or something like that. So tell us what you say to people, Kate. What is the best way to dispose of something?
It's always the same. It starts with the two words. It depends. It depends on, as far as disposing, it depends on the species that you're dealing with and the stage of development that they're in. And so there is a really great resource that I always share with folks from UNH. And it's if folks are curious, it's if they search UNH disposal of invasive species, they have a really great table that outlines the particular plants that people might be encountering. And they're ones that we would commonly encounter in our home landscapes in New England, and the stage of development that they're in, and the recommended disposal method for those particular plants. So
I think that's great, because I think that probably a lot of people hesitate. They'd like to put something in their compost bin, for example, but not sure if that's the best idea. Cheryl, what would you like to add to that?
I was just going to follow up on what Kate was saying. A lot of these, if you can get them before they produce seed, you're probably going to be able to dispose of them a little more freely. So if you're able to pull something and let it die, you know, put it out on your driveway and let the sun desiccate it so that it's good and dead, you can throw things like that on your compost pile, but you need to be really, really careful. You know, Kate was talking about their stage of development. If something has already gone to seed, that's when you need to be really, really careful about your disposal decisions, because you don't want to, you know, add more seeds into the environment at that point.
That's right. Well, Cheryl, I'll ask you the same question I started for Kate, which is, what are you hearing about? What are you seeing? You're in southern Maine. Are there any pests or diseases that you're sort of like, oh, no, not again?
I think the pest and disease things that we always see, the 4th of July always seems to be the day that the Japanese beetles arrive. So they are out in full force, along with some of the other, defoliating beetles. So there's always questions about those and how to manage those. I also get a lot of questions about, can I plant during the summer? Can I plant this tree during the summer? Can I plant perennials during the summer? Do I need to wait until spring? Do I need to wait until fall? So those types of questions, I usually will advise people to, if they have the luxury to do so, watch the weather, try and do it when we've got a rainy stretch coming, if you need to divide or transplant or install new plants. And planting in the middle of summer kind of necessitates a little bit of extra TLC with your plants. Make sure that they are being watered deeply on a regular basis. The little sprinklings of things don't really do a whole lot of good if you're trying to get a root system established. We go back and forth about the pros and cons of using mulch, but if you are planting in the high heat of summer, a layer of mulch or straw can help to moderate the rate at which the soil dries out while you're trying to get these plants established. So, you know, you can absolutely plant in the high heat of summer. You can transplant, you can divide. You just need to think like a plant and know that they're going to be extra thirsty. They're going to need a little extra protection. And again, if you've got the luxury of waiting for a rainy forecast for several days or a cloudy stretch, those things can certainly help as well. So those are the types of things that I usually hear this time of year from folks.
That's some philosophical advice. Think like a plant. Caleb, what about you? What kind of questions are you getting at MAFCA?
Well, first, I want to tack on to that advice about thinking like a plant, which is to remind anybody that's physically able to stick your fingers in the soil, because it's really easy and it makes sense for us as people walking around to go based on what the surface of the soil looks like. But the roots are going down a ways, and the top inch or two may look a lot different than the next 4 or 5 inches. And particularly when it comes to deciding whether you need to water or not, that can have a big impact. But one of the questions I probably got the most this season so far has been about, and I lump them together, the tarnished plant bug and the four-lined plant bug. They are both true bugs that feed on tons and tons of different plants. So vegetables all the way up through ornamental plants, and kind of hearkening back to the question about hydrangeas, if you're seeing what may even look like a disease on some hydrangea leaves, that may just be the damage from four-lined plant bug feeding. So I had a lot of questions and pictures sent my way to help folks catch up on that one.
What does one do about that one?
Oh, it depends on what your situation, but
there's Kate's answer. It depends.
yeah, that's always the answer, is that it depends. But if it's something like a crop where you're maybe less of an ornamental value, you can exclude them with row cover or exclusion netting. Another consideration is that just being prepared for when they're going to show up. They really often like plants that are in hay crops. So when the first crop of hay gets mowed off, that's usually when we get the most questions about it, because they go flying and then land in people's gardens. And then, you know, I always say, as your last case, your last ditch efforts, when you might start to reach for a pesticide, ones that contain pyrethrin as their active ingredient. At least I primarily work with organic growers. That would be the one that would be most effective. But with the big caveat that you're only going to affect the ones that you're actually encountering and that it's reaching, and that there's so many in the environment that they're likely to just have more show up in another day or two. And whatever you sprayed won't be there anymore. So I encourage people to look more towards, one, is it really something that you need to be worried about? And two, do you maybe want to consider different species, especially if it's an ornamental garden? You know, are there other ones that are maybe more or less attractive that are well, I guess, less attractive that would fulfill the same goals?
And Cheryl, I see you nodding. Are you saying, you know, maybe a little bit, letting the bugs eat a little bit is okay?
Yeah, and I think Caleb made a great point too. It's what's your tolerance, right? You know, I think as a lot of us as gardeners have been conditioned towards perfection, there's no perfection in nature. You know, tolerate a little bit of damage. I think part of what I was nodding at too was I've been gardening here at my house for 20 years now, and this is the first year that I've seen four-line plant bug. So that was part of it was like, huh. Interesting that he brought that one up. It's the first time I've had it here.
And Kate, I'll let you weigh in. Are you also hearing about four-lined plant bug?
Not so much that, but it really spoke to me. I tend to, in a lot of situations, celebrate herbivory or a little bit of plant feeding too, because it means that our plants are supporting a broader ecological system. And there's a tremendous amount of beauty in that. And I hope that more gardeners kind of dive in and lean into that. Not saying that everyone wants tattered looking plants, but that's a role that our gardens need to play. And so looking at it through that lens is really important too. And I could talk forever about that.
Well, I don't want tattered kale, Kate.
But anyway. No, but you know, some of our ornamental plants, especially our native plants, seeing a little bit of feeding on those is not something to be alarmed by, and it means that they're playing their role in feeding a wide range of Lepidopteran species, like moths and butterflies, for example, that also need to eat too.
Okay, so before we go to the calls, let's talk about tomorrow. Caleb, as you told me before the program pointed out, we've got some weather coming. What are you going to be doing in your garden? What are you going to be recommending for others to prepare for the storm?
Yeah, so I always feel a little bit like a pendulum in that I'm trying to not panic and then I'm panicking. And sometimes I feel like the panic helps me motivate me to do things that then make me not panic anymore. So please take everything with a grain of salt, but the remnants of Hurricane Beryl are coming through the Midwest, and they happen to be going over an area where cucurbit downy mildew, which is a not very nice disease for cucumbers. So it's headed over that, and then it's also headed over a region just north of Lake Erie where some late blight was found in both tomatoes and potatoes. And, you know, it's late blight. It doesn't do well in hot weather, and it doesn't do well in dry weather. We've got the hot, but we don't have the dry. So I don't know how much, I'm trying to not be too concerned. It's not here until it's here. Some people can overreact and maybe make silly decisions sometimes. But what I'm doing in my own garden, yesterday I did some leaf pruning of my tomato plants to try to encourage airflow. And I will probably be picking my cucumbers thoroughly today. And I might consider a protective fungicide on my cucumbers and my tomatoes. That's always a little tricky, especially when we're talking about heavy rain events, because these fungicides of any kind, whatever your gardening philosophy is, they all work best as a protective and not as a curative. They really don't work very well to cure an infection that's already started. So I may try to apply something prior to tomorrow's big rain event, and then also again Friday morning to protect after, considering everything that had just been washed away. But if I do that, I will probably be removing as much of the produce as I can just to reduce how much I have to wash off later on.
Okay. And Cheryl, what would you add to, are you going to do anything special to get ready for this storm?
It's again, it's the flow of this conversation is interesting because I just ordered some more fungicide just because of all of this rainy, humid weather that we're having to try to protect some things. I think if folks have taller plants, maybe go out and do a little bit of protective staking. And if you can stake all the way to the top of the plant, that would be great, because wherever you stop staking, that's where they're going to snap off. If you haven't protected some of your indeterminate tomatoes from wind, if you don't have those staked yet, you might want to be doing that kind of thing as well. Other than that, I think you've just got to kind of hope for the best, right? I mean, that's part of gardening is you got to roll with it a little bit. And some of these unpredicted occurrences are humbling. But I think, if you can stake some of your taller, wimpier, spindly things, that might not be a bad thing to think about doing.
All right. And before we go to a break, Kate, anything to add to Caleb and Cheryl's recommendations?
Yeah, no, I guess last night we had a little bit of a burst of weather event at our demonstration garden, and it was a little sneak peek of what might be to come either tomorrow or even later on the season. It sounds like it's going to be a pretty active weather season, and so all our sunflowers, or a lot of our sunflowers, tipped over, and so my colleague is staking them as we speak so that we'll be prepared moving forward.
All right, because the sunflowers are just beginning to be in all their glory. Yeah, so any We are talking about gardening on Maine Calling. When we come back from a break, we're going to take your questions. So give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, summer gardening. What are your questions? With me for the hour, Caleb Goosen, who is Crop and Conservation Specialist at MOFCA, Cheryl Rich, Horticulture Chair with Southern Maine Community College, and Kate Garland, Horticulture Professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Share your comments and questions with a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on social media, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we go to the call, so Caleb, I want to ask you, you were mentioning, you and Cheryl both mentioned fungicide. What do you recommend for someone's cucumbers and tomatoes?
So if someone's using organic practices, there are lots of biofungicides that you can do that will sort of inoculate beneficial bacteria. However, if the concern is late blight or cucurbit downy mildew, and this is why good integrative pest management means you need to identify your disease or pest of concern before you act. But if it's one of these potentially very destructive diseases, the most effective protectant in an organic production system is actually copper, so a copper-based fungicide. But of course, people try to avoid using copper whenever they can.
All right. And I see you nodding, Cheryl. You agree?
I do. And I usually alternate between a biological, like Bacillus subtilis, and a copper. And if I'm trying to be preventative, you don't necessarily know what you're trying to treat, so you may not know what your best option is. But generally speaking, you know, Caleb mentioned integrated pest management, IPM, your best bet is to mix it up a little bit too and not go with a steady diet of any one remedy. You need to kind of outsmart what it is that you're trying to attack and come at it from a couple of different perspectives. So I'm a fan of kind of mixing it up, especially if I'm trying to be preventative and not going for a specific condition that I'm aware of. So I think both of those that Caleb mentioned are my go-tos as well.
I'm going to go to Marion calling from Appleton. Hi, Marion, go ahead.
Hey, I just would like to know what you people would recommend for a decent all-around fertilizer for vegetables. Nothing specific, just something that I could use on, you know, that goes for a little bit of anything from tomatoes and cucumbers to some of the cold crops like kohlrabi or spinach or things like that. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Kate, I'll turn to you.
My answer is a non-answer in a way, and I regret to say that, but I always go to soil testing, and it is such a valuable resource. I can't say enough good things about taking the time, and it doesn't take a lot of time to do it. It's not hard to do, but it does take a little patience to get the report back. But taking a soil sample, sending it to the Maine Soil Testing Service, and getting it analyzed to know what is happening chemically in your soil with pH and nutrients and also organic matter to get a sense for what your starting point is, and then filling in any gaps. There's no way to kind of visually assess what's needed. Well, I should say sometimes you can read your plants a little bit and assess nutrient deficiency sometimes, but this helps you really fine tune what you're adding. It helps you avoid over-application, which can have its own issues. And especially at this time of season, applying fertilizers, you really have to be mindful about not over-applying for a few different crops, specifically a lot of our solanaceous crops. They'll, you know, applying fertilizers this time of year will encourage more vegetative production, and they won't produce as many fruit, for example. But you can also get fertilizer burn issues by over-applicating. So I know that was not the answer that you were looking for, but you can request a soil test kit online or pick one up at your local extension office. And there are videos on how to do the soil testing. I will say that the report that you get back is only as good as the sample that you send in. So that, you know, meaning that you want to get a good little representative of the soil type that you have by grabbing small samples that are 6 to 8 inches deep, I'm saying, for a vegetable garden, and mixing several of those up into a clean container, and then filling your soil sample bucket, which is about 2 cups or box, I should say, with that mixture, so that they're going to be testing something that's representative of your whole garden. But using that information, it tells you the next steps. And you can always call your extension office and we can help you walk through that report and decipher that report and give you a shopping list even.
Okay, Elizabeth on Facebook says, I have lost my broccoli and now my kale to a groundhog. I tried trapping it with a have a heart. I tried sprinkling various things around the plants like black pepper, hot pepper, and Epsom salts. I'm going to try a radio. Any thoughts, Caleb?
So in my own experiences, I've been fortunate enough, and some folks may not like this approach, but I've been fortunate enough to live far enough away from other folks that I can just terminate the groundhog as quickly and humanely as possible. However, I know a lot of folks live in town or with close neighbors, and it's just not an option. I do know my father has had some success with leaving used cat litter near the groundhog's hole. And it's just sort of providing the sense of a predatory species, and doing anything like that, constantly harassing them. If you have a dog and you can get them to be annoyed that they don't feel safe in that area, they may up and leave and go somewhere else. It is always tricky if they have a refuge nearby that they would feel just as secure.
Sure, they can go move under the neighbor's shed if they leave your yard. Kate, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, we have a very healthy groundhog population at our demonstration garden. And one strategy that I've really found a lot of success in with all the crops that don't require pollination in order for it to produce what we're hoping it to produce, such as the broccoli and cabbage and all the leafy greens, is using lightweight row cover. And so we make hoops with a heavy duty wire, or sometimes we use like political sign wickets or PVC to make hoops, and grow them under lightweight row cover, or there's a product called Protect Net that's really, really good. And that is a physical barrier that seems to work with our woodchuck population. At least it gives them enough of a deterrent to make them go elsewhere.
Okay, well, Cheryl, I'll send this next one to you. We're on the topic of critters, it seems. This is from Wynn, an email. It seems I've been raising a huge crop of hungry chipmunks over the years, and they absolutely love tomatoes. I've already lost a bunch this year, and this morning one of the chippies left a thank you note on the deck, a half-eaten one. This is not the first time. They've historically decimated my crops. Any idea how to deter those little critters? Cayenne, castor oil, coyote urine, what works best?
That is a tough one, and I feel that person's pain. I think I live in a chipmunk condo community or something here myself. I think some of the things that you can try to do is, if you have areas that you think are really attractive habitat for them, you know, if you've got, and this is contradictory to some of the other things that we talk about, if you've got a brush pile or something like that, kind of keep it a little bit further away. Kate's suggestion earlier of the row covers, the floating row covers, the Remay, that can work, but the timing is tricky with tomatoes because those are plants that require pollinators. I was in my garden 2 days ago, I think, and there were 5 of them just taunting me and running around and around and around. So I would certainly be open to any suggestions that anybody else might have, because that's part of the fun of doing this show, is that I get to learn as well. Making your yard a little less appealing to them, and sometimes that's not feasible. They're going to climb any kind of fencing that you put up. you know, I'm open to other suggestions. I apologize for not having a slam dunk response to that one, but chippies are tricky.
Yeah, yeah, and I think if you have some foxes in your neighborhood, it helps. But there are lots of chipmunks. Okay, we are on the topic of critters, so I'm going to go to one more. I'll send this one to you, Caleb, and then back to our calls. An email from Frank: deer have been eating a lot of things I thought were immune from them. Who thought they would eat Solomon seal? Does anything work to repel them?
Oh, even people eat Solomon seal sometimes. So. Deer are there. It's a point in time that we're worried about, right? Because in the late winter, early spring, when your garden starts emerging and you have lush, healthy plants, they maybe don't have as much left in their natural habitat to feed on. And similarly, towards the end of summer, things are not looking quite as good, and your garden is maybe at its peak, and that's when you're going to see the most. But we also have the issue of deer population pressure. I live near the woods, and not in a very suburban area, and I actually have no deer problems in my garden, almost. Whereas I know in town, people tend to have more. The trouble with deer is that they will acclimate to anything that you do to deter them eventually. So whatever the answer is, don't get comfortable with it and change it up. So sometimes it's a garbage bag that's taped to a post and it flaps around in the breeze and that makes a lot of noise. And eventually they'll get used to that. And then maybe you have to get out there with a boombox on an extension cord. Although, again, I don't know if you can do that depending on your neighbors. So it's really about changing up that deterrent. If it works for your garden and your setup to have an electric fence, it's good to look into what are called three-dimensional designs, 3D electric fencing, basically two separate fences to sort of disorient the deer. It's also—
Right, because they could easily leap over one.
Oh, yes. And it's really important to, especially if you only have a single row of fencing, to bait the fence I use just peanut butter, turn the fence off, walk every few paces, smear a little peanut butter on the fence and then turn it on. And essentially what you're doing is you're training the deer to respect the fence so that they come along, sniff that peanut butter, get a little zap on their wet nose and decide not to mess with it. And again, if they know there's something they want on the other side because they've already been eating it, they might just jump over it anyway. So you have to do it preventatively. And you also have to maintain that training because eventually they'll just ignore it and jump over it again, unless you're sort of retraining them to have a little fear of it. And there are other fencing options that are non-electric, but they're much larger. Some, however, black poly woven fencing will sort of disappear into the background visually, which that makes a nice option.
I'll go to Larry calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, my beech trees have what they're calling for short beech leaf disease. If you want, I can try to parse out the Latin name. I'm not that good at that. My question is, what can I do about it? The forester says I can put something called, where'd it go? Something, polyphosphate 30 on it. But the company that makes the stuff won't sell it to people. It's only sold to businesses. And you got to buy 50 or 5 gallons of the junk. What can I do to protect my trees? I would estimate somewhere between 1/4 and 1/3 of my trees are beech.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Larry. I see Caleb nodding. He knows about this. What do you recommend?
It's not necessarily going to be welcome advice, but I think we are sort of in a transitionary period with our environment right now. And beeches are suffering from beech bark disease complex, and now they're suffering from this beech leaf disease, which is likely at least a nematode that inhabits the leaves, but there may be some more involved with just the nematode. It's probably only economical to try to control beech leaf disease for prized ornamental specimens. For a larger woodlot, it's probably not going to be economical to try to control for beech leaf disease. So you might want to be thinking more about transitioning, you know, what sort of replanting could we be doing for species that are perhaps going to be more resilient with our potentially changing climate.
Thanks, Larry, for your question. Good luck to you. We have so many calls coming in. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, I also want to ask you all about new plants that we can plant in Maine now that we didn't used to be able to. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and today we are getting answers to your gardening questions. Our guests, Cheryl Rich from Southern Maine Community College, Kate Garland with UMaine Cooperative Extension, and Caleb Goosen with MOFCA. If you're quick, you can join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Kate, before the break, Larry had asked us about beech leaf disease, and you have a little maybe possible ray of hope.
Yeah, I don't want to get your hopes up too much, but there, you know, for those that do have the prized beech tree, I do believe that the state has recently approved the use of Arbortect to kind of try to manage some of the nematode populations in those infected trees. So, and the state of Maine has a really fantastic resource page that they're very regularly updating on beech leaf disease. So if you search Maine beech leaf disease or reach out to your local extension for more information, we can keep you in the loop on what's most recently known about the product and also the disease itself. But they're doing a great job monitoring.
Great. And Cheryl, before we go back to audience questions, I do want to ask you about the USDA only recently updated the plant hardiness zone map. No surprise to anyone who's been paying attention to the climate. And I'm wondering if there are any plants that are beloved south of here that people now can plant in Maine, certain roses maybe. What are you finding now grows here?
I think we're having more luck with anything really that's a zone six, especially kind of in the coastal and kind of up the river pathways a little deeper into the state. One comment that I will make about that is when the USDA reestablishes the hardiness zone numbers for our region, that's an average. Those are temperatures that have been collected over a decade or more. So they are guidance. They are guidelines. They are not sure things because
they're not guarantees.
they are not. You know, and Mother Nature is going to slap us every once in a while with a minus 25 degree cold snap, and all of us cocky, confident gardeners that are thinking, yay, we can grow all kinds of crazy new things. You know, she's going to keep us real. She's going to remind us every once in a while who is in charge. And I think another important thing to think about, too, when we're talking about plants and their hardiness, is that sometimes the tops of plants will get zapped if we're talking about woody plants and or evergreen perennial plants. But the roots may still persist. So, you know, we talk sometimes about root hardiness versus shoot hardiness. And we are probably going to have more success with plants with well-established root systems and a little bit of snow cover. So I think we can kind of push that hardiness zone thing a little bit deeper into the state, perhaps in areas where we may still get good snow cover, because snow cover is like a blanket. And what's most important to plants are that root system getting them through the winter. But in terms of specific plants, people are going to have, I think, much more luck growing things like lavender. I think they're going to have, you know, there are some figs that are perfectly root hardy here now, which is kind of fun to think about. My colleague was messing around with a crepe myrtle on the South Portland campus that's traditionally a zone 6-7, but that's a favorite, almost think lilac for more southern climates and stuff. And we've had that over winter. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun for gardeners to experiment and expand what they traditionally grow. But I think we all need to be cautioned that that these hardiness zone recommendations are based on seasonal averages. And we always have those outliers that are going to make us realize that maybe we're not as warm as we thought we were. But it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun as a gardener. So I feel a little conflicted saying that because the warming is not a good thing. But from a gardener's perspective, you know, the other quick thing that I would say about that is it's with warming temperatures and longer growing seasons, we also get more insect cycles. We get more disease cycles. Our irrigation needs are going to be increased. So there's the upside to it, but there's also things that that we may not have anticipated.
Yeah, Caleb.
Yeah, I just want to add that to build on that, the hardiness zones are based on minimum temperatures expected in a year. And some of our winter events are not so much about the absolute minimum temperature that they're reaching, but sort of the sequence of weather leading up to it. Do you have that snow cover? We often are not having as much snow cover protecting roots as we used to. And folks may remember last year, there were no Maine peaches because all the peach trees got zapped. And it wasn't that they died, but their flowers were taken out.
It was the timing. Yeah. So I'm going to go to Linda calling from Rockport. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi there. My roses were doing great until like 1 week ago. And now the Japanese beetles are piled on. It's crazy. They're piled on top of each other, chewing them apart. And I'm loath to use pesticides, but I have this bottle of neem that I've never done before, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, oh, is this the time to use it? So I'm wondering what you all say about how I can deal with these Japanese beetles.
Kate?
It's definitely that time of year. I liked what Cheryl mentioned. It's 4th of July is when they all come to town. So, yeah, the adults have emerged and are feeding on a wide variety of plants, including those roses. They definitely have their favorites, like roses and grapes and raspberries. Primrose is another trap crop that we happen to see them on all the time. But I know it can seem really daunting and even uncomfortable for some folks, but hand picking is something that I think is a very valid thing to consider, especially if you have if you're a small scale grower, whether you're a home gardener and you've one or two rose plants. I highly recommend going out there on a regular basis. And even if it's just 3-4 times a week, there is research that has shown that it can really reduce the impact of the damage that happens on the plants if you're really consistent about it. And there are some, you can have it be just like a small little dish of soapy water. Doesn't have to be kerosene or anything like that. I've talked with a lot of folks that are very aggressive in what they choose to put in their container, but just soapy water in a shallow dish is an option. Another option is I've seen a really clever kind of funnel type trap where you put two milk jugs opening to opening and you tape them together and you make you cut the top, the bottom off of the one that's inverted on the top. Hopefully I'm describing it well enough that it makes a funnel into the other milk jug and you put a little bit of soapy water in there and then they're less likely to fly back out at you. And some of the research has actually shown that like doing that hand picking in the evening can be a little bit better too and reduce that that buildup of damage that's happening on the plant. So the other piece to consider is leaving the beetles that have the small white dots on their heads, because those have been parasitized by the tachinid flies. And ideally, if you can leave as many of those in place, those will be continue to keep that parasite population around to hopefully keep the population a little bit more in check. So I'd say hand picking if you can, that'd be great.
Good luck to you, Linda. And I think we have another caller who wants to talk about Japanese beetles. Mark, what is your solution?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a solution yet. It's just an interesting thought. I'm actually out in my garden right now picking off some of these Japanese beetles as per the previous caller. But I noticed that we have an unweeded patch in our garden, which we were neglecting, and we have evening primrose weeds that have grown up to about 3 or 4 feet high. And I noticed that those things are just swarmed over with Japanese beetles. And we have a grape arbor here, and we have some peaches, and we have fruit trees and things. And it seems that, could be just wishful thinking, but it seems that there is a significant reduction in Japanese beetles on the plants where we don't want them to bother.
And Kate, I'm going to go back to you. There's a philosophy behind this. This isn't just for Japanese beetles, right? To have like a trap crop or something you sacrifice to keep it, the bugs off the plants, other plants?
Yeah, I quickly mentioned it. I'm so glad that you said that. because, yeah, it does. There are some plants that might be more appealing to particular insects, and that happens across the insect world. I'm sure Caleb has many examples of trap cropping. And yes, it can be a management tool somewhat passively by just simply having those plants nearby, but in conjunction with also like focusing in on those areas when you're doing your hand picking and going to those primroses and knocking off as many, it helps you be a little bit more efficient when you have, especially if you have a little bit of limited time to hand pick, you can go to the primroses and knock off a bunch right all at once too.
Go ahead, Caleb.
Yeah, I think I just know that I always get questions about the traps, the Japanese beetle traps. And I just want all the listeners to know that the pheromone lure that's used there is very attractive at long distances to the Japanese beetles, but it's not necessarily, they're not necessarily clever about finding it at short distances.
So it just attracts them to your garden.
It attracts them to your garden. And my usual line is that they make great presents for neighbors.
You want them that's mean.
As far away from the plants that you're trying to protect, if you're going to use them at all.
I have such a hard time at the hardware store, and like when someone wants to go buy one, I just have to hold back and not say anything.
Oh my gosh, Kate, I think you ought to go up to strangers and give them some advice. Mark, thank you so much. We're going to see how much we can squeeze in here. We'll go to Don calling from Portland. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi. Back to pests. This year, for some reason, the squirrels will not let up. I'm growing primarily herbs and a bunch of leafy greens, and they get in under the plants and dig holes. And every morning, there's half a dozen plants that are sort of teetering on the brink. Is there any way
my goodness.
To keep those things away?
Well, we did have a caller, Charlene, recommend for woodchucks chicken wire. Roll it up and put it on the ground. Would chicken wire, Cheryl, work for squirrels, or what would you recommend to Don? I have a feeling if you have chipmunks, you also have squirrels, right, Cheryl?
I do. Yeah, chicken wire could work. Chicken wire or hardware cloth, but you've got to cover kind of the top of the plant as well, because they can climb up it and just kind of get down in. And the nice thing about chicken wire or hardware cloth versus some of the row cover is that the pollinators are still going to be able to get through it. But if you've got any kind of critters that are digging and things at the base of your plant, if they are tunnelers, and not necessarily the squirrels, but the chipmunks certainly are, they can tunnel right under anything like that. So it could work, but remember they climb. So you've got to kind of completely box it in if you want to try and do something like that, because they're just going to find a way over and in if they're that determined.
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced that squirrels have like the most intelligence per brain size of brain of any animal. They're so tricky. Don, good luck to you. Let's see here. Diana sends an email. Suggestions for protecting delicate fruit like peaches and raspberries from the storm. Caleb, you have thoughts?
I would just say that there's probably only so much you can do if your raspberries are ripe. Certainly take them, harvest them prior to the storm. But a lot of the time, it's not as bad as you think. And even if you see some peaches that have left the tree, you can sometimes think of that as having thinned your crop for you, so that the ones left that are still there will be bigger and better.
All right. You know, we just have about a minute left in the program. I really wanted to talk about eco-friendly practices, and I'm realizing we're out of time. But Kate, I just want to say that generally speaking, whether you have a question about something specific, or, and this is probably true for all three of you, or you want to be a little, you want to attract pollinators or do other eco-friendly practices in your garden, the Cooperative Extension is a great place to start, right?
Absolutely. We have a pollinator friendly gardening certification or garden certification that is not only a certification process, but more so intended to be an educational resource for folks. So it offers information about providing food resources for pollinators, but also protecting the habitat and water resources as well. So it's a great guide for anyone that's interested in those practices.
And I know, Caleb, I've got your page open right now, the MOFCA page for farmers and for gardener trainings and all sorts of your beginning gardener video series. So there is help. If you didn't get through on Main Calling today, lots of help available. Thank you so much to our guest today. Kate Garland is with the UMaine Cooperative Extension, Caleb Goosen with MOFCA, and Cheryl Rich with Southern Maine Community College. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can go to mainecalling.org to sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also check out the Maine Public Vox Pop app. Maine Public Vox Pop app is easy to download. It is free and it will enable you to ask a question or make a comment whenever you'd like. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.